This is Backstory with us, the American History Guys. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th century guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, the 19th century guy.
And I'm Brian Bella, 20th century American history guy. For years, the United States has held a dubious distinction. We have more people in prison by far than any other nation, but now we're outdoing even ourselves. As of this year, we've hit a new record. More than one in every 100 adult Americans are behind bars.
Now, whether that's good news or bad news depends on your outlook. Many on the right see a direct correlation between these rising prison populations and falling crime rates. But a lot of liberals wring their hands at their statistics. They say the system isn't working, and they point to the high number of people who return to prison and the ravaged communities they leave behind as evidence. And there's also the racial disparity. For Black Americans, it's not 1 in 100 behind bars, it's 1 in 15. And there's no getting around the financial cost, no matter your politics, $49 billion of state money last year alone.
Each week on Backstory, we pick a topic from the news and try to put it in historical context. This week, our topic is punishment in America. How have we dealt with wrongdoers over the years? What is the ultimate goal of our penal system? And how has that changed over the course of our nation's history?
To begin, we're going to hear from a person who's spent more than 3 decades in prison, not because he's run afoul of the law, but because he is the law. His name is Devon Brown, and for the past 3 years, he's been the director of the Corrections Department in Washington, D.C. Before that, he headed corrections for the state of New Jersey. I recently had a chance to ask him a few questions. Welcome to Backstory, Mr. Brown.
Well, thank you.
Well, the numbers are staggering, as you know better than anybody. How is it that we are the leading incarcerator in the world?
Well, you know, I have this expression my dad taught me about "In God We Trust." And he wasn't talking necessarily about what the minister says each Sunday. He was talking about the almighty dollar. It's no question that corrections is big business, tremendously big business.
Could you tell me who are the players in this business of corrections?
Well, in terms of the private sector, the Correctional Corporation of America, one of the mega companies that specialize in providing cell beds across the country. Wack and Hut, another
right.
one.
Security firm.
Absolutely.
Now, what about on the public side? Who are the players on the public side who have a real stake in more prisons?
Well, I'll be candid with you. The corrections unions, as we've built more prisons, it's only natural that we're going to need more correctional officers to oversee those prisons. Most of these individuals are members of unions. They pay union dues. That provides the means to influence public policy through campaign donations and through lobbying.
So a lot of people would say, though, look, crime is going up. We got a lot more crime, so we needed to build a lot more prisons. What do you say to that?
I say there may be some grains of truth, but at least currently, crime is not increasing. But yet the prison population continues to increase. Moreover, when you look at the types of crimes that are responsible for imprisonment,
right.
we're talking about rather low-level drug offenses.
And now I want to bring up a very sensitive topic, but I want to bring up the topic of race.
It is indisputable that there is a correlation between race and imprisonment, where people of color are, in some cases, 13 times more likely to be imprisoned than their white counterparts.
That's a remarkable statistic.
Well, it's candid. And another observation, when we think of where this occurs, you know, our history as African Americans, deeply rooted in the South, deeply rooted in slavery, but astonishingly, it is not the South that's responsible for the high levels of disproportionate racial incarceration. It is the progressive Northeast. It is states like Connecticut, New Jersey. It is Pennsylvania. It is Wisconsin and Minnesota. Once you cross that Mason-Dixon line, you are more likely to be subjected to the criminal justice system if you are African-American.
You made a very controversial statement a while back proclaiming that our prisons were really the new plantations.
Well, the comment was really focused upon the disproportionate numbers of African-Americans that comprise our prison and jails. New Jersey led all of the states in that disproportion. 81% of New Jersey's prison populations were people of color.
81%.
People of color and Hispanics.
Mm-hmm.
So to go into a prison and see an ocean of melanin was just shocking, absolutely shocking. And what was just as shocking was to see who the correctional officers were, for the most part, who occupies positions of control over these individuals, who in a very real sense control their lives.
So, Mr. Brown, what do you say to, let's say, the young African-American man who is behind bars right now, perhaps because he has a 1,300% better chance of having been put behind bars than the white person? I mean, it's one thing to point out the statistics, but you run this D.C. correction system.
I say use a bad situation and turn it into a strength to reap the benefits, and there are benefits. Get an education. Get vocational training. Learn how to control your anger in such a way that you use it towards constructive ends. That's what I tell that person. Never lose sight of your family. That when you get out, your focus should be on better assuring that your children don't make the mistake that you did, and encourage them in every way through your example.
Devon Brown heads the Department of Corrections in Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us on Backstory.
Well, thank you for having me.
Peter and Ed, I want to jump right in and put you guys on the spot. You actually know something about plantations. What do you think about that plantation analogy?
I think it's a very powerful one, Brian.
Well, yeah, and the resonances go even deeper. You know, in the antebellum South, in the slave South, there were virtually no black men in the penitentiaries they established there because you had slavery instead.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But immediately following emancipation, numbers very similar to what we have today came to be the dominant force in the South. And so the penitentiaries virtually then had almost no white men in them.
Yeah.
You had to literally kill somebody if you were white to get into a Southern penitentiary, which really just became machines for incarcerating black men.
And you think back to the colonial period, the idea that you have to lock up evildoers, discipline them, get them out of the community is entirely antithetical to the way it was in colonial America. This was a reform effort to find a way to deal with a roving and dangerous population, the so-called dangerous classes, and to do so in a humane way. The whole idea of the penitentiary was both a kind of a physical hygiene to improve the health of prisoners and also a mental and spiritual hygiene to give penitents a chance to think about what they'd done.
And where did that all start, Peter?
Well, the most famous case is in Philadelphia.
That's the Eastern State?
Yeah. It goes back to the 1780s, the early reform efforts, and it's in the 1820s, finally 1829, the Eastern State Penitentiary opens up. It's the fulfillment of this reform Quaker vision of rehabilitation.
Well, a little later in the show, we're going to talk about the reform model that replaced Eastern State. But first, let's take a phone call. Let's go to the phones.
We got Pam on the line. She's calling from our hometown of Charlottesville, Virginia. Pam, welcome to Backstory.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
What do you got on your mind today?
Well, I've been thinking about how society has changed over time. We were traveling in December in Bali, and it seems like a lot of their punishment is through shame and guilt. And I suspect that we were like that at one time. See, here comes the American part.
We're still like that in my family, Penn.
And it still works in families, but you know, we've become a much more deracinated society, and so it's harder to do that on the large scale. You know, scarlet A's don't work, and public stocks, I guess, are cruel and unusual. And what I'm wondering is, when did we make that change from public shaming as a, you know, method of controlling people to just tossing people in the clink?
A lot farther back than you think. The whole idea of the penitentiary is that you're removed from public display precisely so that you could commune with God. It's just you and the Bible and some bread and silence in the early Philadelphia prisons. And the whole idea was that you'd replace, in many ways, shame with guilt.
There are two big things that have changed, and they were already changing in 18th century America. One is urbanization. The more you bring people together in anonymous circumstances, the harder it is to make a shame culture work.
Yep.
And then there's connected with urbanization is mobility. People yep. move around too much. So there have to be other ways to manage deviance in a mobile modern society.
And it's interesting, at the same time the penitentiary was created, lots of other kinds of institutions were created that were trying to do the same things. Schools, for example.
Even universities.
Yeah, well, that's right. But also, you know, poorhouses and orphanages.
Oh, that's right. Sure.
And hospitals. Mm-hmm. All of these things emerged within the same 15 or 20 years. And the whole idea was that by using institutions, you can control various kinds of deviant behavior.
Yeah, at the same time, Pam, we got these Bible societies, we got these national groups that began to work on people's morals, people's values, so they would internalize these controls, and we wouldn't have to rely on these institutions.
So what you guys are saying is that the birth of modern individualism is also the birth of the great institutions that control life in modern society. So individualism and institutional development are coincidental. In fact, they explain each other.
Makes perfect sense.
Good. Thank you, Pam.
Pam, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
This is Backstory, the show that looks to the past to understand the present. I'm your 20th century guy, Brian Ballow.
I'm your 19th century guy, Ed Ayers.
And I'm the only real historian of the bunch. That's 18th century guy, Peter Onuf. We're talking today about the history of punishment in America, and we have another phone call. It's Brett calling us from the Big Apple, New York. Welcome to the show, Brett.
Well, thanks very much. I have a question for you that my wife actually suggested. I have to give credit where it's due.
Okay, let's see how good the question is, and we'll decide if there's credit.
Okay, all right. We're both wondering about the penal treatment of the mentally ill and whether asylums were historically viewed as punishment or treatment, and if the former, when that started to change.
There was an influential book published back in the 1970s called The Discovery of the Asylum, and the whole idea there was that in the early 19th century, they began to segregate out all the different people who had been considered deviant. They would separate old from young, and they would separate the poor from the criminal, and they would separate the mentally ill from what they considered to be sort of intentional criminals. It began before the Civil War in the 1840s was the sort of the peak. And often in the really heart-wrenching literature about all this, they would talk about going into some isolated jail somewhere, and somebody that we would obviously recognize as mentally ill, you know, would be just sitting there surrounded by and victimized by people who were just, you know, cutthroat criminals. And so very self-conscious reformers. We think of Dorothea Dix, D-I-X, as the main person who drove all this. And her crusade became to establish places where the mentally ill could be given refuge. And the United States was at the cutting edge of all this and prided themselves on our soft-heartedness. It's interesting, it's about the same time that the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals was developed, a sort of generalized sense that we should be far more sensitive to the suffering of other sentient beings, even people who are mentally ill and could not express themselves.
Brett, there's a deep irony here, though, and that is that in the name of reform and in the name of humanity, again, in the 1960s, Americans began to deinstitutionalize those people in mental asylums, the thinking being that we can't separate people from their families, we can't separate people from their communities. There was also a strong motivation to save money because institutionalizing people is very expensive. And the combination of those factors led to lots of people being released, put back on the streets. And wouldn't you know it, a lot of those folks started coming back in the prison population.
Right.
So the story that Ed starts in the early 19th century kind of comes full cycle by the 1970s, again, in the name of reform. And today, one of the key problems we have with the prison population is a very high percentage of that population is what we would say suffering from mental illness.
I think it's very interesting to consider the fact that we once, and as you say, in the 19th century, considered ourselves perhaps some of the gentlest and most understanding of societies, and treating the less fortunate. And nowadays, it seems there's more of a wave of people who would have us be ever tougher, and before our prisons get fuller and fuller. And it seems to be quite a difference there in the outlook of at least certain factions of society in the 19th century and today.
Yeah, I think what you think in some ways is the asylum has leaked into the general society so that people now who are mentally ill find, you know, the asylum comes in the form of medication. You know, a consistent impulse, you could say, all along is we want people just to be quiet and stay out of the way. And if that works best by putting them in a separate room or a building far out of sight, that's fine. If it involves just drugging them so that they won't be a problem, that would be fine too.
Very true. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Brett.
Earlier in the show, we discussed the beginnings of the penitentiary system. The idea there was basically that removing lawbreakers from society and making them think really hard about what they had done was the best way to rehabilitate them.
Yeah, that didn't work out all that well because by the early 19th century, there were jailbreaks all the time. Within 2 years, the opening of Eastern State Penitentiary, they'd already had the first escape. Riots were common, calling out the state militia all the time. And they turned out to be really expensive to run these penitentiaries. So once again, it was back to the drawing boards. And this time, reformers came up with a brilliant new approach. Forget about repentance, they said. Let's put these guys to work.
Now, Ed, we've all seen those images of those plantation-style prisons down south with the guards on horseback, places like Angola Prison and Louisiana or Parchman Farm in Mississippi. But this is different, right?
Yeah, that is right. This new forced labor system started up in your neck of the woods, Peter, upstate New York, to be exact, in places like Auburn and Sing Sing. And a little while ago, Brian and I sat down with Rebecca McLennan, a historian out in Berkeley, who's just published a book about this new prison system. And I asked her to describe what it meant for prisoners.
Essentially, the daily regimen of your average New York State convict at Auburn or Sing Sing prisons in the 1820s consisted in lockdown in cells by night and then lockstep marching to congregate factories within the prison grounds by day, all under a rule of silence that was backed up at the end of a whip, as well as through a number of other corporal punishments of the sort that would have really shocked Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Rush, and the early Republican inventors of the old penitentiary system. Manufacturers moved machinery and raw materials into large purpose-built workshops, which were often built pro bono for them by the state, and put prisoners to work 12, 14 hours a day, making barrels, sewing clothes, manufacturing sanitation carts for burgeoning cities such as the city of New York, even making firearms and locks in some prisons. And it was handsomely profitable to the contractors. And the state itself didn't do too badly either. Generally, the state caught the costs of incarcerating convicted felons by up to 2/3 or 3/4 in some instances.
Did
this desire to take advantage of the labor of these convicts, did that put upward pressure on actually putting people in jail, or was that simply a separate phenomenon?
It's very hard to prove, but certainly a number of critics of the system were very persuaded of this. And their critics, who included free farmers as well as industrial workers who felt that they were unfairly competing against cheap prison labor, pointed to upticks in incarceration, conviction and incarceration rates whenever demand in a particular industry was on the increase.
Well, certainly in the South, with the very low threshold, shall we say, of arresting black men for just about anything,
mm-hmm.
it was a widely commented upon practice. If somebody needs some kind of work done at the local level, at the state level, arrest went up.
I want to ask, in your story, the workers are kind of the heroes, or at least major change agents, right? They lead to a different kind of prison system.
Right. Labor historians have tended not to recognize the extent to which the anti-contract prison labor movement really galvanized American labor and the farmers' alliances in the late 19th century and got them to turn up to the polls and vote in statewide elections and referenda against contract prison labor. And this happened in New York, it happened in Mississippi, it happened in state after state.
So it was a hot button issue.
It was a hot button issue. Now, the major parties became wise to this and, in a sense, incorporated this aspiration on the part of free workers and farmers to take prisoners and their product out of the free market to protect, in other words, workers and farmers from competition with forced sweated labor of prisoners. And this contributed to the demise of the populists because one of their major issues had been quite successfully absorbed by the major parties.
Now, how did we manage to miss this? I mean, I've read a lot about populism and the movement, mm-hmm. and I've never seen this mentioned as one of the key issues. How did you spot this?
Well, I kept wondering why it was that progressive era prison reform seemed so urgent. What was really driving them to establish educational, athletics, recreational programs of various kinds in the prisons? Why were they all of a sudden interested in the 1910s in bringing psychiatrists and psychologists into the prisons? And what I discovered was that as a result of political agitation on the part of workers and farmers, the structuring activity of the American prison system, that is, productive labor, had been driven to ground. And state governments everywhere had thousands of prisoners on their hands who had nothing to do. So progressive era penal reform consisted, above all, in an effort to replace the disciplinary activity of labor through other forms of structuring activity, including baseball, athletics, marching bands, prison theater, movies, and eventually radio in the 1920s as ways of absorbing the energies, which are always dangerous in a prison from the point of view of administrators, absorbing the energies of otherwise idle men.
So if this was such a big political issue for so long, why does it seem so invisible now?
Well, I would say that once prisoners were removed from the productive sphere, from the American economy, now bear in mind in 1885, American prisoners were producing what today would be $30 billion, or the equivalent of a full $30 billion worth of work on an annual basis.
Wow.
And once prisoners are removed from the productive sphere, they're no longer of much concern to organized labor. They're also held in facilities that are far flung from the major population centers, so that they've physically been invisibilized as well as in economic terms. I think that what will eventually precipitate a political crisis around the current moment is precisely the dawning reality of the cost of maintaining such institutions, at which point we are quite likely to see a repeat of some of the politics of the late 19th century over where the capital should come from for sustaining and maintaining these massive institutions, and whether private enterprise is invited back into the business of punishing
convicted
felons.
Certainly that's, and you've shown us that's one way that the state has gone in the past.
Right. Well, at virtually every turn, that is the way in which the state has tended to go.
So these things tend to go in cycles, and you think maybe we're on the cusp of maybe another cycle of change.
Yeah, I mean, many historians have talked about the way in which our age is a neo-Gilded Age, so perhaps we are on the cusp of a neo-progressive age.
Very interesting.
Oh, I'm worried about neo-anything. But this has been a really terrific discussion, and I want to thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Rebecca McLennan is an associate professor of history at UC Berkeley. Her new book is called The Crisis of Imprisonment, Protest, Politics, and the Making of the American Penal State. Thank you so much, Rebecca. Well,